With us now from the East Coast to talk golf and television and whatever else comes up is Damon Hack, now 11 years as a member of the staff at Golf Channel. After a career in the newspaper business and magazine, worked at Sports Illustrated, New York Times, Newsday, Sacramento Bee. And my disclaimer, as always, is that I've known Damon since we were both young and had some hair. And that was covering 49ers football in the San Francisco Bay Area. Damon, it's always a pleasure to chat, and thanks.
Strange, it's great to spend some time with you. It's amazing to think how long ago we've known each other and how long ago it was covering Steve Young and Jerry Rice and Tim McDonald and Merton Hanks. It's remarkable. It's literally half a lifetime ago.
You know, you see those questions on social media. Tell me how old you are without telling me how old you are. Yeah. You just told us how old you are, how long ago you covered this by saying Merton Hanks and Steve Young and Tim McDonald. And who else could we throw in there? Bryant Young.
I mean,
there's some guys who've been around for a long time. And that was probably, I don't know, again, probably close to 30 years ago that we did that. And it was great. It was great work. That's for sure. But golf is your life now, mostly. You do a little bit of Olympics work in those every couple of years Olympic cycles. But is golf still as exciting as it was when you started covering golf as a writer for newspapers and magazines and now 11 years in television?
It is. It's been a fascinating last year plus, especially not just because of all of the controversy with the PGA Tour and Liv. The journalist in me loves the news aspect of this story. And then just personally, I've started covering golf events for NBC now, not just doing the studio work for Golf Channel, but actually being on site, interviewing the players, interviewed the players post-round at the Arnold Palmer Invitational in Orlando, and then the Players' Championship outside of Jacksonville at TPC Sawgrass, Ponte Vedra Beach, interviewing Scottie Scheffler after he won that beautiful gold trophy. So it's been fun for me. I might have said it to Mike Tirico. In fact, we were doing a rehearsal before the Players' Championship, and I was sitting up in this beautiful perch above the 18th green at TPC Sawgrass, and I had this big smile on my face, and I was just excited about sitting in that chair on Thursday and Friday where Tirico sits on Saturday and Sunday. And I was like, wow, this is such a cool spot. It's so great. And he goes, look at you, Damon. You're always so positive, and Mike is very positive as well. But it's neat when Mike Tirico tells you you're positive. And I said, Mike, every day is like the first day for me. And that's kind of how I'm feeling even 11 years on. So I know I should touch wood and be very grateful for the job and the role that I have.
Gave me the opportunity to bring this up about the new gig, doing the post-round interviews. How did that come about and that little addition to your role come about?
Yeah, you know, I've been doing mostly studio work for Golf Channel since 2012, Morning Drive first, Golf Today also, and then occasionally getting out to some of the events. Either the show would go on site or I'd get to do the occasional post-round interview. I started to ask to do a little bit more and had done a little bit more, maybe three or four events a year. And then Molly Solomon, who's executive producer of Golf Channel, Tommy Roy, who's the producer of Tournament Golf on NBC, they reached out to me and said, Damon, starting in 2023, we want you to be a more regular presence on the NBC golf broadcast. So myself and Cara Banks, another terrific journalist and broadcaster, were kind of splitting that role in 2023. She's doing the Ryder Cup, the Open, couple of the Florida Swing events. I'm doing the U.S. Open, did the Players' Championship, Bay Hill, and I'm doing Texas as well, the Valero Texas Open, as well as the match play. So it's just, you know, it kind of gets me closer to my old newspaper and magazine job, is getting to ask questions and they answer questions and you're trying to read their body language and their emotion and coming off of a football game and coming off of a golf tournament or coming off of a round of golf. It's like, I used to think, going back to our Niner days, some of my favorite stories to write for the Sacramento Bee were when the Niners would lose, just because of the theme. You could capture the band-aids and the bandages strewn about this the locker room of despair. And it's just like everybody, the sky is falling, and you know, the crazy Bay Area sports fans when the Niners would lose. And if a guy or gal, you know, makes a double bogey on the 18th hole and you have to talk to them, that's a challenge to kind of paint that picture and try to capture their despair. Or if it's a birdie putt to win it, you want to capture that elation as well.
I don't think anybody realizes how difficult that job is if they've never done it, because it's spontaneous, but it's also what I know, what I've learned, what I've watched. What is the best piece of advice you got or you could share with us about making those post-round, post-game, those live, momentous, right after it's done, interviews work?
Yeah, I've talked to Steve Sands, Tom Rinaldi, some of the folks who've been doing it for a long time, and our philosophies are kind of similar. You know, short questions lead to long answers. Don't answer the question in the question. You know, as much as you might think this is your moment to shine, the viewer at home wants to hear from the athlete. So set the athlete up to tell that story. Who, what, when, where, why, and how are as timeless now as they were in third grade. Don't ask yes or no questions. Don't ask, you know, how are you feeling right now? I feel good is usually the answer, or I feel bad. So, you know, lean on some of those journalistic rules that I've always tried to stay out of the way. Sometimes dead air isn't a bad thing. Sometimes they're kind of thinking of a way to respond and, you know, don't always jump on the end of a response because they may just be warming up. But namely, it's the short questions leading to long answers. And also, be prepared. I always have 3 or 4 questions ready to go. I listen to have a follow-up that maybe I wasn't expecting to have. But I prepare, know each player that's on the leaderboard that I'm going to have to talk to. Maybe the wife is out there, or a child, or a grandparent, as in the case of Scottie Scheffler, whose nearly 88-year-old grandmother was walking every hole. I was able to ask him about that. So just being prepared, as you always want to be, and then also setting the athlete up to shine. And by doing that, it's asking short questions.
Yeah. Yeah. And listening, I'm glad. I hope the students are hearing this. Pay attention to that, because you do have to listen. Yes, you have to have some questions prepared. You have to have your research done, but you've got to listen to what they say, because they're always going to say something to you that you didn't quite expect. And the other thing is, our friend, the late, great Pedro Gomez, used to call these off-ramp questions. Don't do off-ramp questions. In other words, what did you think, Miss Golfer? Or was it this other thing? Don't give them an option. Just ask them a direct question straight. Don't give them a yes or no, or a maybe, or a this or that. Don't give them an off-ramp, which is what Pedro used to call it.
Such a great point. It's a wonderful, I think it's a difficult and wonderful challenge to be at 100 different golf tournaments and to try to find different ways to ask similar questions. And not just lean on cliches and not just lean on, you know, the easy questions. It's a wonderful challenge. And you could be sitting around for 2 hours and then it's your time to be on camera. You know, maybe they're throwing a lot of golf shots and then it's your time to shine, and you have to be ready to roll when that camera comes on.
You know, it's interesting because I've done those things in live broadcasts where there's a big arena full, and they put the sound into the arena. So you're listening to yourself asking questions. My point is that you really have to focus no matter what's going on. You really have to keep that moment just right in that simple little focus. It's you and the interviewee and whoever might be talking to you in your ear, but you really have to kind of zone everything else out, or you can lose focus and not get to that next question, which really needs to be asked, right?
Yeah. Perfect example, on Sunday at the Players' Championship, I'm standing on the 18th green, kind of off to the side as Scotty makes the par putt and wins, and Tommy Roy's in my ear, and, you know, so where's the family? The family's up on the hill behind me. The wife comes down, so we're trying to wait to let the celebration marinate. Don't want to jump the gun, so Meredith, the wife, comes down and gives Scotty a hug, and I'm telling Tommy, this here she comes, and there's cameras everywhere, so he can see it too. Do we go in now? No, wait. Meredith is waving for the grandmother to come down, and the mom and the dad and the sister. So this conga line of Scheffler family members are coming down the hill, and we want to let that breathe and let him have the hug with his dad, the hug with his mom and his grandma and his sister. And it was after all of those hugs and celebrations, Tommy says, okay, now you step in. So I step in, do my four questions. And he's a pretty soft-spoken Texan, you know, but I got it just enough out of him. He talked about, you know, the pressure of carrying a lead and sleeping on a lead. And I tried to ask him, how are you different this year than last year when you won four times? You've already won two times this year. And I said, I see that your eyes are moist. What's it been like having your grandmother here? And he said, it's so hard to do this interview. And my dad is right over there looking at me. And you could tell him he was kind of holding back tears. So, yeah, you think on your feet, you observe, you lean on those powers of observation as both you and I have for our entire careers.
We try to remember this as almost like a three-pronged animal. It's journalism, yes. It's telling stories about human beings and the drama that goes with it, yes. And it's an entertainment business. Yeah. And if we can get all three of those factors in one moment like that, then you walk away and say, okay, it's been a good day. I've done my job, right?
Absolutely. It's amazing to see this build into a crescendo on Sunday, because Thursday, Friday, Saturday, you're telling stories. I'm doing a 30-second report on this player and that player, and I'm talking to players after the rounds Thursday, Friday, and Saturday as well. And it all builds this incredible crescendo on Sunday. And you know that, you know, a lot of the golf fans maybe aren't watching every single hour of coverage Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. But on Sunday, the diehard golf fan is probably watching that last hour, hour and a half, and wanting to hear what that player has to say, what was going through his or her mind. It's just, it really has been fun. And to do it on NBC, where Tommy Roy, who's, as Paul Azinger pulled me aside once, he's a major champ, who's our main analyst, who says, Tommy Roy is trying to win an Emmy every single time he is on the air. And that level of expectation, I told my wife, I've told my colleagues, I love it. I love having a producer who has such high expectations and wants every broadcast to be a top shelf. It's a wonderful challenge to try to meet. And at this point in my career, to still be hungry and to have that type of expectation, I think is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, it isn't to say that Tommy Roy does the work so he can win awards. He wants to do the highest quality that is award-winning quality work, because you can't show up every week and every month of every year for decades and say, I'm doing this just to win awards. But it is nice when people say, attaboy, attagirl, that was really good work. Way to go.
Yeah, he's a savant, and he really is a terrific job of, you know, kind of going from this shot to that. And his colleague, co-producer Tom Randolph, and director Joe Martin, they just have a wonderful, you know, symphonic relationships, a lot of simpatico there, where they're able to really kind of tell beautiful stories. And as one of the NBC newbies, I want to make sure that I'm carrying my weight as well.
Yeah, and this doesn't require a comment necessarily, but if everybody had the opportunity once just to see how golf is produced, because not every one of those shots is live, and you have how many different announcers and how many different pieces of microphones on the course and how many cameras, and there are so many options to directors and producers, and how that choreography works and makes it look like it's just a seamless live presentation and everything is just happening perfectly in order. And if golf was played like the guy on the 17th is hitting his putt, and then the guy on the 18th waits until he's done, and then he goes and does his putt, and then the guy who drives over on number 16 would, if they would just do that all in order, it would be great. But it doesn't work that way, does it? It doesn't. And keeping track of all of that and dropping it in at the right place and putting those scenes in that make the narrative that the action is presenting is really, I think, the genius of putting golf together on television. I do.
It is. It is different than a football game of 100 yards or 92 by 50 hunk of wood in basketball. It is different dramas unfolding over 5 miles of 18 holes, and you just don't know what's going to happen. And you got cameras everywhere and microphones everywhere, and you're trying to figure out, you know, what shot do I go to next? And it's I've actually, before I ever had this job, I sat in the truck once just to watch Tommy Roy do a broadcast over 4 hours, and to watch him, he's like literally doing all this, his arms and hands are going side to side, he's like very, very animated, trying to figure out where to go next, and he's wiping his arm this way and doing that, talking to so-and-so, and it's really amazing to see it all come together.
With Matt Kuchar, who just pulled within one of Tiger Woods' all-time match victories in the WGC Dell Technologies match play, 36-35. How much is that longevity and how much is that production?
I've been out here a while, but I think you got to have both. I mean, anytime you're in the conversation with Tiger Woods, it's a very cool thing and certainly a feather in the cap.
To beat a young player like Victor Hovland, one of the top young players in this game, what does that do for you from a confidence standpoint?
Listen, I knew I had my hands full. Fortunately, I got up to a 3-up lead with after three holes, and Victor was nice to me on the greens. He had a couple putts just horseshoe out that...
Damon Hack with the Golf Channel and NBC Sports is with us. I'm John Schrader, and this is Watch the Media. So golf still has a problem, does it not? And I don't want to use the word problem, but I think it is that it's still not diverse. It's still mostly a sport played by white men at the PGA level and mostly by white women at certain levels, if not all. And so what kinds of progress have we made in these respects?
Yeah, I think it's been slow. I think it's picked up in the era post-George Floyd, 2020, COVID. I think that a lot of people in golf realized that golf had a role to play in this kind of racial reckoning. And we have these racial reckonings seemingly every 30, 40 years, depending, sometimes less than that. I found myself in a role of being a bit of a sounding board to some of the people involved in the game at the tour and the USGA and different governing bodies. And I could see that there was some deep thought and some deep pockets that that needed to be reached. And I think that they have been in terms of, you know, youth programs and outreach and, you know, looking at diversity in college golf and HBCUs and first tee programs and different things to really kind of shake the trees and shake the foundation of this game, because much like America, which, you know, came to be in a segregated way, you know, most African Americans just did not grow up knowing what golf was, including myself. I wrote a column for Golf Journal recently about how I came to golf, and it was really by accident. I used to drive by golf courses as a kid, and no one in my family would say anything. There was no attraction, no connection to the game. And if not being a sports radio guy after college working part-time, where I saw a station director who walked by me with some golf clubs and invited me to play golf, asked me if I ever play it, and I said no, I never probably would have picked up golf clubs, or at least not at that point in my early 20s. So I see golf as like much of corporate America and different companies, they are looking at ways to diversify, but it's also tough when you've got centuries and decades of systemic barriers to overcome.
You're a journalist, but you're asked to sort of be an advisor, to be a sounding board, to be a person who helps in this process from, as you said, the PGA Tour, the USGA, and just about everybody else. You're comfortable with that? Are you happy they asked you, and are you happy to contribute?
I am. It can be burdensome sometimes when the African-American in the room is asked to help solve all of these racial issues and problems as if, you know, it's our problem. Like, you know, it's like, well, you know, let's everyone contribute. And most people ask me because there's ignorance. There's fear. I think there's discomfort. And I think they see me as someone who has kind of weaved and bobbed his way through different worlds and different neighborhoods. And I have for my 50 plus years now. I think I have a role to play, you know, as someone whose parents went to Compton High School, but also someone whose parents, you know, went to college, and that I grew up in a house where college was not a choice. It was a given that we'd go to college. And but I also know what it's like to have cousins who made different choices, and I feel comfortable in different worlds. So I do my own mental health checks. I meditate. I make sure that it's not overwhelming me, because these are complex issues that are tough to unravel. But I do feel that in my time in journalism, in sports journalism, in golf, I do have an important role that I can play. And if I can help and be a sounding board and a person that brings some thought to this process, I'm okay with that too.
You know, I like to look at it like, you know, change happens when everybody in the room has invested in it. Everybody in the room feels like it's important, especially the people in the room who aren't initially impacted by it. And I'll put it very bluntly, especially the white people in the room, the white people with privilege in the room, the white people who are country club golfers who haven't had diversity growing up playing golf. When all of those people, or a great number of those people, are invested in the process, then change happens. Do you see a lot of us, those people in the process, invested in it?
I see more than I have previously. I think there's still some discomfort. There's still some folks that are unsure of what steps to take. And I often say, you know, it's about allowing yourself to be uncomfortable and asking some tough questions of not just yourself, but your peer group as well. And I do think more people are involved. When I talk to minorities in sports journalism in general, they feel like there's more allyship. There are more people that don't necessarily look like them, but that are still wanting to help and have a voice and be a part of the solution. And I think it's about not just being neutral, but being vocal and visibly anti-bigoted and anti-racist, not just kind of being a nice person standing on the sidelines.
Yeah, you know, the PGA Tour long ago, and I don't, not long ago in the big picture, but quite some time ago, a couple of decades ago, said, we're not going to go play golf at country clubs that traditionally discriminate. But let's be honest, and again, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but Augusta, the Masters, is like the most conflicted I get in sports and has been for my entire career, because Augusta, the Masters tournament, is like, wow, it's just so beautiful and it's so historical. Of course, the clubhouse is an old plantation home, but it's historical and it's everything that you kind of hope a television show would be. But it's still almost all rich white men who are members. It's still, it's now crowing about its women's amateur, which I think you guys are carrying, which is awesome. But it's still, to me, and you don't have to respond to this if you don't want to, it's still, to me, like the last great bastion of Southern white male power. And I can't watch the Masters without thinking that. And I'm sorry to those people who love the Masters. And I will tell you that the little devil on the shoulder and the little angel on the shoulder are yelling at each other all the time, because I do watch the Masters, but I'm conflicted all the time. And again, that's how I feel about it. And I wish it wasn't that way, but it is.
Yeah, I've been covering the Masters for 20 years. I haven't always felt comfortable going. All I can say is, having been of late and seeing some of the things that have happened, including the endowment of a HBCU golf team, the creation of a Payne College women's golf team, honoring Lee Elder, though late that it was, having him at least be a part of that honorary starter on Thursday morning with Jack and Gary Player before Lee passed away. I think Augusta has grown and made some steps forward, but I understand your thought as well. And, you know, listen, covering this game, I have felt great conflict. All I can try to do is, with my love of the game, you know, speak truth to power, hold folks accountable at the tour, at Augusta National. When I walk through those, I walk with my head held high and make sure that everybody knows who I am and that I'm where I'm supposed to be. And I think the more that I can do that and maybe try to change things from the inside and keep the game honest and keep USGA, PGA Tour, Augusta National honest, that's going to be my role to play. But I understand your point as well and your emotion with that as well.
One other thing I want to talk about is Live Golf, the Saudi Arabian sovereign fund supported, funded golf tour that Greg Norman runs, and that poached a number of really high quality, world-class golfers and took them away from the PGA Tour. How do you see that playing right now? And can you look ahead and see how that's going to play? I know some changes with the PGA Tour have already been made. They've added money. They've restructured some of the things. They need to make sure they keep the Rory McIlroys and they keep the Colin Morikawas and they keep the young talent. And they're working hard to do that. But how do you see Liv's impact on the game right now and maybe in the short term?
Yeah, I think it's been pretty minimal. I think the players who have gone mostly in their 40s, mostly at the end of their careers and earning power, I think they kind of took the easy way out. I think they made their decisions based on money and not on competition. And I think that's hurt the professional game as a whole, not having Dustin Johnson, Cameron Smith, for example, two major champs, two of the best players in the world, not having personalities like Bryson DeChambeau, Brooks Koepka, Patrick Reed has hurt the PGA Tour as well. I think this LIV Golf entity will last as long as the public investment fund is interested in. Right now, it's not making money. To hear the LIV Golf folks say it, this is a long-term play, even if there's some short-term loss. They've got a new TV deal with the CW. I don't know, the exact numbers of the deal. I know that their ratings right now aren't very good. But they're saying all the right things. Like, well, we're at the beginning. We've had just, a handful of tournaments so far. We're in our second year of existence. We're a startup. I think that the competition level of LIV does not hold a candle to the PGA Tour. Yes, does Golf Channel carry PGA Tour events? Of course. But I know that the best players in the world, the majority of them reside on the PGA Tour. And that's where the best golf courses and best tournaments and the best players reside. I don't think this disruptor league is going to take down the PGA Tour. I don't think there's going to be, at least in the near term, any way they're going to coexist with this lawsuit happening. And mostly, I think it's been sad for the game. Sure, it's been a talking point, and people are interested, and people like salacious stuff, and you got a lot of that with this story. But for pure competition, I feel like it's hurt professional golf.
The TV critic in me tried to watch it over the weekend, and I will say it's a tough watch. Maybe it'll get better. Maybe they have a lot to learn. I'm not asking you to be a critic of it, but it's a tough watch. The question I do have for you regarding that is, what have your folks at Golf Channel and NBC Sports and the PGA Tour asked you all to do relative to that? I heard Mike Tirico talking a little bit about, made some references to LIV Golf during the Players Championship. I don't think it's taboo, but it's not something you want to talk about a lot. What is the direction that you've gotten, if any, from your bosses?
Yeah, my boss said, talk about what you want to talk about. We don't have a directive. You can't talk about LIV. You can't mention LIV. We have shown, I want to say, when Henrik Stenson won, I think we showed his winning putt, because he had just given up or been let loose of, relieved of his captaincy for the Ryder Cup. So it was germane to the news that he had just left that role and won the next event on LIV. We're allowed to, on our show Golf Today, we have a lot of opinion on that show. We're allowed to speak our mind. Myself and my partner, Eamon Lynch, did some great reporting for Golf Week magazine, but there's been no directive on, only 30 seconds an hour can you talk about LIV, or you can't talk about LIV. We're kind of able to speak our mind as I'm speaking to you now. And I just think it's an entity that's less than competitive and less than compelling than week-to-week PGA Tour golf, that's for sure.
Yeah, you want compelling, you want entertainment, you want competition. The money that was had by a number of these golfers is immense. I can't say honestly that I ever have nor ever would ever expect in my life to have a decision to make. Do I decide what to do? And there's like nine figures high nine figures, like $100 million or $200 million or whatever Mickelson got, or $700 or $800 million that apparently they offered Tiger, and $500 million they offered Rory. I don't know how much money it is. I've never had to make that decision, but I do know that I've made decisions in life that are on much smaller scale than that about who I want to work for and who I want to be associated with. And honestly, and I'm not a hero at all, I would do it again, but I've quit jobs in the past because I didn't trust the people I worked for, and I did it without having another job. So it's possible at very, very small scales to make those judgments, but I don't know if everybody can or would do that, but I know that it would be difficult for me to work for people if I really had big questions about where that money was coming from. And that's, again, an editorial comment, frankly.
Well, like those folks have literally made their bed and have to sleep in it. And I wonder how, you know, calmly they're sleeping at night, how easy they're sleeping at night. Are they conflicted with where the money comes from? And as a journalist, I'm not a big fan of folks who put out hits on journalists. That's where I sit and where I stand. And I think the golfers that made the choice, obviously, they chose a different outcome, and I just wonder how they sleep at night and how they kind of make sense of the decision and the choices that they've made.
Have you had many opportunities in your role to have heart-to-heart conversations with some of the folks who left the PGA Tour?
I haven't. I imagine I may see some at the Masters tournament in a few weeks' time, because the Masters is allowing LIV golfers to play if they're qualified. So, I'm looking forward to it. You know, should those conversations come about, I'm sure the media sessions will be pretty interesting in a few weeks' time in Augusta, but I have not had any chances to, but I definitely have some people that I've spoken to previously to that move and haven't spoken to them since. Just in part because we've chosen different paths, but yeah, I look forward to seeing what those conversations are like, not just myself and them, but PGA Tour players and folks that they used to compete with on a weekly basis who made a different choice, and whether there's going to be a little bit of tension in that first major championship of the year.
How invaluable, if that's the right word, has it been that Tiger Woods and Rory McIlroy and a couple of other people who are very well respected among all professional golfers have really taken a very public, firm stand on this?
Yeah, I think it's been important for their legacies and how they see golf. I mean, to hear Tiger talk about the importance of competition and 72 holes and digging it out of the dirt, and you get paid for your production and for winning. And I love the role that they've played, and their friends, Tiger and Rory, and their business partners as well. And I just think it's been a very strong front for the PGA Tour, and very crucial for their commissioner, Jay Monahan, to have the support of Tiger and Rory in this time of fractured professional golf. But it's been impressive, especially considering Tiger, you know, was pretty agnostic for much of his career and just focused on winning golf tournaments and taking home trophies, that he's been very vocal in this very fraught time in professional golf.
Yeah, I found that to be interesting. I'm glad you mentioned that. I found that to be interesting because agnostic is a good word. And I think, you know, disappointingly to a lot of people, that he couldn't have jumped in frays more often and more fulsomely. But that's another matter. You know, 11 years there, how do you keep it fresh every day? How do you make it exciting and new? I mean, I'm not complaining at all, but you know, the travel and the hours and the weekends and the nights and all of this stuff can really wear you down in our business. And the idea is to stay fresh on television and be excited and let the consumer know that you're really excited about this. How do you keep it fresh? How do you keep it lively? How do you just make sure you slog through some of that stuff?
Yeah, new players helps. New relationships helps. I tell my kids, this is like my homework. They see me on a night at home and I'm prepping, and I've got these note cards that I'm going through and sifting through. It's a continual education. It's a gathering of knowledge. It's like reading a book. And I just, every day on a golf course is different, whether it's your own round of golf or you're covering someone else's. You're going to see bounces you've never seen and situations you've never encountered. And I just, to me, in some ways, this job is just a continuation of the education that I've always enjoyed from when I was a little kid in the classroom to as a 51-year-old man now who likes to learn, who likes to be challenged, who likes to embrace new things. I think that's really how I've been able to keep this fresh, and how, as Mike Tirico said, I'm walking onto the golf course and every day feels like a new day. It's what I told him, and it's really, really been true. And I hope I can somehow maintain that bright-eyed perspective for another decade or so.
And it really helps to have a smiling, loving wife and three kids at home to walk home to and occasionally just kind of change gears, right?
No question about it. It makes the family time that much sweeter, that's for sure.
Hey, Damon, thanks. As always, lots of stuff we can talk about, but we're both busy. And thanks a million and congrats, and go get them, as always.
Thank you, Shrades. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye. Damon Hack with the Golf Channel and NBC Sports with us on Watch the Media. I'm John Schrader.
Ben Griffin playing in the Players for the first time, but you've played in a couple Junior Players Championships. How would you describe your comfort level on a golf course designed to make you uncomfortable?
I mean, comfortable at times, but this course can definitely make you uncomfortable, especially down the stretch. You know, some very tough holes to finish up, especially with where the wind is.